Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We begin a series here in this hour that will be running for the next, well, for some time here on Issues Etc. An important series on lay vocation. You know, we use this term vocation. We'll get a definition of that early on in our conversation with Uwe Simonetto, who will be with us throughout this series. The subject today in the first part of our series on lay vocation has to do with Uwe's vocation, or at least his vocation, although now it has changed a little bit, and that of a journalist. You know, people, especially Christians, have such a jaded view of journalism, of the press, sometimes deserved, sometimes not, that one might wonder whether or not a Christian can be a journalist. You know, Luther wrote during the time of the Reformation whether or not a soldier, too, can be saved. One might write a similar treatise nowadays. Can a journalist, too, be saved? We'll get Uwe's answer to that early in our conversation. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe's a regular guest. He's an international journalist. He's resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. Uwe, welcome back.
Great to be back.
All right. Let's deal with the jaded view that many Christians have of the press. A deep distrust of television, radio, print, magazine, maybe not so much internet, of the journalistic pursuit. Is it a vocation that a Christian can carry out in good conscience, journalism?
Todd, it's definitely a vocation like any other. Indeed, it is probably the most important vocation you can think of nowadays, since the world is so dependent on the media for information, and since in a democracy in which we live, where the voter is actually the sovereign of the nation. And therefore, the media are the only ones who can inform the voter. How else would he get the information to base his decisions on? So it is indeed a vocation. But you're quite right. People have a jaded view of the media, and for good reason. I have been in this trade. Next year it will be exactly 50 years that I have been a journalist. And even as a child, I was already doing journalism, so it's even longer than 50 years. And I have seen a dreadful transformation of journalism, of the character of journalists. I wouldn't say it's a general thing, but it is in elite journalism especially. You'll find very good, hard-working, solid journalists out in the provinces, in small towns, in medium towns, and indeed in good newspapers. But there is a reason for the public dismay over the performance of the media, precisely because I believe that journalists have often lost their sense of vocation. They are not, in the Lutheran sense or Christian sense of the word, primarily serving their neighbor, but they're very often self-serving. So that is something one has to discuss in detail.
And so in not properly carrying out their vocation, perhaps the disdain that so many hold for the journalistic estate is because those who occupy it, some of those who occupy it, are not doing what journalists ought to do. If they were doing what journalists ought to do, do you think they would have that kind of disdain for them?
Definitely not. You see, there's been a shift. What is the primary quality that one should expect of a good journalist? The highest quality of a journalist is to have a near endless sense of wonderment. You walk through life wondering, with curiosity. I'm in my 70th year now. I am still excited over every bit of information that I collect in my research for my stories. It's an almost erotic sense of wonderment that you have. And unfortunately, many, many journalists nowadays no longer have the sense of wonderment. They actually want to wag their fingers into people's faces and want to tell people off and want to tell people what the real world is really like. It's hubris. And hubris is precisely what my teachers, that is, my desk editors, way back, the ones with scurf on their shoulders and unshaven chins and reeking of beer in the morning because they've been drinking too much. But boy, did they have a sense of wonderment and did they have a sense of ethics. And they said, you are not the center of attention. You don't even matter other than that you are the transmitter of the information and the transmitter of what's going on. The most important person is your reader. Nowadays, you would also say, of course, your listener and viewer.
I remember a movie that came out in the 80s called Network, and it dealt with kind of a television, fictional television network newsroom and the editors right. and the various anchors and whatnot. And one of the anchors said on camera, he began a sentence, I think. And the editor watching on the teleprompter or watching on the monitor said, no one cares what you think. Yeah. You're not here to tell us what you think.
That's precisely it. When you start, to begin with, if you have to say, I think, you already know that he's just trying to gain time to formulate his thoughts. That's already bad, you know. But secondly, no, nobody cares what you think unless you're a commentator, unless you are, that is your job description. It's a legitimate thing to be a commentator, an editorialist. Then you may think, but then you don't have to say, I think. Then you'll write for the editorial section of your newspaper, and that is it. But this is not your regular run-of-the-mill reporter.
What do we mean when we use this word vocation? And you talked about it being connected with service and love for the neighbor.
Correct. Christians, and specifically Lutherans, believe that God calls us, hence the word vocation, vocatio is calling, calls us not only to service in the church as pastors, priests, organists, or what have you, but also to service in the left-hand kingdom, in the world, in the secular realm, where we are to perform our work as whatever we are, journalists, bakers, you name it, to the best of our abilities, serving our neighbor, serving the other. It is an act of love. And unless you love other people, unless you love your readers, unless you love your viewers, and actually the people you write about more often, or some may be rather unlovable, I admit. Unless you do that, and you only love yourself, you are not a good journalist, at least not in a Christian sense. Then you are serving something else, which is evil. I believe that a self-serving journalist basically does something evil.
So what is a journalist calling? What is the journalist's vocation, in essence?
Well, the journalists have many vocations. The first and most important vocation is to collect the news correctly as you can, to understand what people are saying and to report about it accurately. Then, of course, you have a higher level where, with proper research and proper knowledge, you analyze the news. That you also have to do. But once again, you have to be fair. You analyze your news, the news events from all sides. Then you might arrive at a conclusion, which is somewhat subjective, I admit. Not an editorial, but still a conclusion. It's your conclusion. It's your analysis, but it has to be earmarked. It has to be properly... the readers have to be properly told this is an analysis. It's called news analysis. You do not mesh the two things together.
To what degree is, before we talk about journalism isn't as well, to what degree is journalism, like so many other Christian vocations, also a discipline? It strikes me that the temptation to vary from one's vocation as a journalist would begin at the very moment one encounters the raw data for their news, the way they collect it, the way they put it together, the way they assemble it and pass it on.
Yeah. You see, here is something, there's a wonderful German word. You have to tame the innere Schweinehund, the internal pig dog. And the internal pig dog is the guy who says, oh, here is something I really have to get my teeth into, and I really have to opine on this one. And, you know, if I cobble this story together in the proper way, then I get my opinion across, if even surreptitiously. Or, you know, that is, of course, totally wrong. You can't, you're not allowed to do that. You can do this in an opinion piece, but you cannot do it in a news item. Another thing is campaign journalism. If you do campaign journalism, you suddenly ride a horse that everybody else seems to be riding, and you want to head in the same direction. Another great danger is idleness or time pressure, both. I mean, the time pressure, as you know and we all know, is a horrendous thing in journalism. Under time, you have to produce your copy, you have a deadline, you have to, your newspaper has to be out at a certain hour, or your broadcast has to be out at a certain hour, and you have to get as much information together as possible. And you might actually have a competitor who could steal the item from you, so therefore you have to be out. So the temptation to be sloppy or to skip certain parameters here is very great. And then, of course, the greatest temptation is that you take yourself too seriously. There are journalists out there making up to $75,000 per speech, and a lot of others who are in the $25,000 to $30,000 range. They are more interested, clearly, from a pecuniary point of view, in their speeches than in the actual work of collecting and reporting the news. So when you become a star, when you become the story, rather than you reporting the story or analyzing the story, then you are in a very grave danger of actually missing your calling.
What journalists, let's just name a few names if we could.
Yeah.
In your opinion, after 50-plus years of doing this, acting in this vocation, which journalists known to our listeners do you admire as men or women who really, in spite of perhaps the fame and the notoriety they've gained from their vocation, are carrying out that vocation well, Christian or non-Christian?
Well, Christian or non-Christian. Look, I don't want to even, there are not too many names I can name. I think, for example, as one of the biggest money makers, giving speeches, who is nevertheless a first-rate journalist, and therefore I don't begrudge him his good money. It's Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, the editorial. He is a columnist. He is wonderful. I'll tell you what journalists I admire, just in general terms. Having been in combat, spent a lot of time in combat in Vietnam, those poor bastards who are out there in Humvees, who are embedded with the forces in Iraq, which is anything but an enchanting country. Vietnam had charms. Iraq at the moment had no charms. I can't see it. I can't for the life of me see it. I mean, where's the good wine? Where's the good food? Where are the beautiful women? Where are all these things that one could admire? And none of that is there. Where are the charming dinner conversations over a wonderful Vietnamese or French meal, which enlivened us and comforted us in combat? These guys in Iraq who are day in and day out with the forces are doing a magnificent job and are have earned our admiration. Problem is that there are wise guys sitting in back offices somewhere. Usually, you see, these are the, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but this is important to know. The worst invention of contemporary journalism are the news managers, or are they, the news managers. They're the ones who pipe questions into television interviewers' ears. And this is why you get such moronic questions, because these turkeys don't even know what they're talking about. Instead of the journalists, let me give you one example. There is a woman on CNN, and I really thought she was one unmitigated nincompoop, because of the questions he kept asking. Her name is Carol Lee. Because here we were at the beginning of the war in Kosovo, and at that point, you had some sort of mantra going, where are our NATO allies? Where are our NATO allies? Why do they ask this question, whether NATO allies? Because the bloody newspapers don't report what the NATO allies are doing. And then they don't report that the Americans are NATO allies just as much as the Brits and everybody else. Anyway, so here she is interviewing, believe it or not, the British commanding general of the Allied forces in Kosovo, whose deputy and then successor was a German four-star general. And then she said, well, what are the NATO allies doing? And I looked absolutely flummoxed, looked at her and said, is she nuts or something like that? Later I realized that this was a question somebody piped into her ear, because when I saw her later on and doing proper research in Israel, for example, and all of that, she was an outstanding reporter. She was full of a sense of wonderment. So I have to did her a grave injustice. I really thought she should be committed. I mean, you know, she should be fired. But actually, this is what is happening, that because of a perceived disinterest in international affairs, and it's a perceived interest, these news managers then develop questions that they make others ask, and the questions are often totally idiotic.
What is a journalist? We talked about what a journalist's calling is. What is it not? Give us a list, if you would.
Well, number one, a journalist's calling is definitely not to harm others, harm innocent people. And I think this is one of the worst things that are happening now. A lot of people are being harmed by faulty or prejudiced reporting. A journalist is not, by definition, a star. He can become a star, as some Ed Morrow, for example, became a star thanks to first-rate journalism. And then ultimately, like any good doctor who performs fantastic operations, saves many lives, he becomes a star in quotation mark. But by definition, just because he's a pretty girl, or he's a pretty girl, or he's a pretty boy, and has the right, has a good dentist, and can looks good on camera, you're not a star. You are you're just somebody who's asking questions. That's number one. Thirdly, you're not a propagandist. You're not an ideologue. If you want to be a journalist, and you want to be a real journalist, and if you want to serve your neighbors, don't serve an interest group. Don't serve any particular political wing. You can do so, again, if you're an editorial writer, but if you're a reporter, you can't. And if you do, people will find you out, and they will distrust you.
We're talking, and here in the first part of our series on lay vocation, about the vocation of journalism. Uwe Simonetto is our guest, an international journalist. We will take your questions or comments on journalism for the next half hour. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe is also a resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. You're listening to Issues Etc., and we are back live this Monday, November the 21st. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727.
When change occurred.
Ah, yes. Couple questions here as we go into our break. When did journalism go from being what used to be called the Fourth Estate, and essential to Western democracy, to what it is now, especially in the West? When did this actually take place?
I believe it happened in the 1960s. It occurred when a journalist moved from being a craftsman and one of the people to being a pseudo-intellectual. It is definitely a product of liberal arts education. When I became a journalist, you moved directly, usually from high school, and later may have studied, but it's the liberal arts education that closed the mind of many, many a journalist. You thought you were something better. You see, when I trained as a journalist back in the 1950s, my buddies were the cop with whom I stood at the bar whooping down numbers of beers, or the headmaster of a local school, or a plumber, my neighbors, people I lived with, people whose company I enjoyed, people who presumably enjoyed my company, because I wasn't anything better than they were. I was just another craftsman, and they knew it. They knew they could trust me. They knew me at the bar and my colleagues. And so therefore they knew that when I wrote in my local newspaper at the time, later the Associated Press, I would not hurt them or hurt their interest, and therefore not the interest of the population at large.
So this shift from craftsman to, what was the other term you used there?
Pseudo-intellectual, pseudo-academic. You know, journalism suddenly became an academic discipline, in quotation marks, and not just a craft. And I think that's what happened. All the great journalists of the past were people who learned their work on the job. It doesn't mean that you should be uneducated. Obviously, journalists have to be educated and have to have a fast grasp for things. You have to be able, within a week, to collect enough material to write a doctoral dissertation on a totally alien matter, you see, and I can give you a lot of that. But it's that. It is. And when you think that you are an intellectual, you have a calling to do to something higher than serving your neighbor, then, of course, you become dead earnest. Have you noticed how boring the New York Times is? When do you ever get a good giggle, a good laugh out of them? They are so boring. Their lips must shrink the minute they join that newspaper. They can't be enjoyed. The only guy I know who can laugh is Johnny Apple, with whom I was in Vietnam, who writes about food and booze a lot. Well, I don't blame him. He's good, but I mean... And so many American journalists have become so dead serious.
And it goes along with what you said before, and that is taking oneself too seriously. Yeah. My experience here behind this microphone has been in the past, and thankfully not so much lately, of being reminded constantly by my producer in the middle of an interview that it's my job to ask questions.
Yeah.
Questions. And he would type up there, questions, or he would type up on the screen, right. You are not the expert. Yeah. Or he'll just say expert mode, which is his way of telling me my job is to ask questions, not to, in an interview, to opine.
Correct. That's precisely it.
And now he's got the journalism degree. I don't.
Yeah, but he's a good guy. He's a good Lutheran, you see. What can I tell you?
We're talking with Uwe Simonetto. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend another 15 minutes with him, or about 10 minutes or so. In our first of a series on lay vocation, we're starting with Uwe's vocation, that of journalist, and we're talking about this way of serving one's neighbor. I think the term itself probably is as descriptive as it can be. Keeping a journal of what people say and what happens in events, and we call it the news. When we come back, we're going to talk about serving the neighbor. We're going to talk about what qualities a journalist needs to possess. And something that Uwe has mentioned already in our conversation, that is the blurring between the editorial page and the front page, where opinion and news somehow meld together. Hopefully he'll have time to tell us a story about a horse in a bar. We'll be right back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Wouldn't it be great if we had a record of the actual discussions, dialogues, and disagreements of the 16th century Reformation, what the Reformers said, what they wrote, and what they meant when they said and wrote those things? Such a record exists. It's called the Book of Concord. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November is Concordia, a reader's edition of the Book of Concord. Concordia Publishing House has two bookstore locations where you can find the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. When you visit, ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, Concordia, a reader's edition of the Book of Concord. Remember those two locations, 3558 South Jefferson, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton.
Real scientists, do they believe in Genesis? Answers with Ken Ham, an editor and writer for Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, one of the things you often hear evolutionists declare is that all real scientists believe in evolution. They insist you can't be a true scientist if you believe in creation. But what's your response?
Mark, I usually respond by talking about one of our conference speakers like Dr. Jason Lyle. Now, he's an astrophysicist, and that means he's an astronomer who's basically taken a lot of extra math. The more he studied and interpreted the evidence for creation, the more he became convinced it's true. As Dr. Lyle looks through his telescope, he sees God's handiwork, and so he accepts the account of creation in Genesis that God created the heavens and the earth. Many people don't realize that there are over 10,000 real scientists in America alone who believe in literal Genesis. For instance, there's Dr. Russell Humphreys, who used to work at the Sandia National Laboratories, involved in nuclear physics, and Dr. Stephen Austin, who is a PhD geologist who's done extensive work on the Grand Canyon and Mount St. Helens. And I've personally met hundreds of professional biologists, chemists, geologists, and physicists all over the world who make no apologies about the fact that they get their answers from the Bible.
God's Word also provides the answer to the question, where did all the different races or people groups come from? Ken Ham looks at that fascinating topic in a free booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
The niche specialty of LCMS World Relief, along with disasters getting at least 95% of the dollar given to aid victims, we are determined that that aid be very closely connected with local Christians, local congregations, so the connection between Christ and caring for people is one that remains together. That's who Christ was. He loved people, word and deed. That's what the church does, I'm convinced, on the basis of the New Testament.
That's Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief. For more information, look for the LCMS World Relief logo on our website, issuesetc.org, or call 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief.
Yesterday we learned on our Bible study program that the high priest was to be a descendant of Aaron. Yet Jesus is described as a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. What's going on? We'll talk about it next time on our Bible study program in Hebrews chapter 5 with Pastor John Lukomsky. The Bible Study. It comes your way weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Ten more minutes in our conversation with Uwe Simonetto, beginning our series on lay vocation. We're talking about his life as a journalist and the vocation of a journalist. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for November is called Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. It is, in fact, the Book of Concord, this collection of writings from the 16th century Reformation that is the basis for what it means to be Lutheran. It is a must-read for anyone who is a serious student of the Reformation, a must-read for any Lutheran. Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House. These books are on back order, but that shouldn't stop you from ordering them. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website for more information about the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November. Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, a reader's edition of the Book of Concord. All right, here's your chance to talk to somebody who's covered Vietnam and the Kennedy assassination and so many other things, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Uwe Simonetto. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe is an international journalist, a resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. Uwe, before we go on, so that we don't run out of time, tell us the story about the horse in the bar, please. You say most successful story of yours
in terms of readership and in terms of publication. I was then a very young slot editor with the Associated Press in Frankfurt and a stringer from Franconia, which is a region in Bavaria, called in and said, I have this hysterical story, but it's absolutely true. He said, they had a horse kicked out, banned from the village pub. I said, what are you talking about? He said, this horse for the last 20 years had been coming to the village pub every evening at 5:30 with a satchel around his neck. There was a 50 pfennig piece, about 12 and a half cents at the time. And the innkeeper took the money out and poured a nice frothing beer down the horse's snout, and off it trotted again back to its barn. And this was beautiful. Nobody paid any attention to it. It would never even have hit the news, because everybody was used to it in the village, and even the neighboring villages, that the horse was a regular there. Until the horse left a sort of big pile of steaming droppings on the, you know, in Germany, in a German pub. This is a clean joint, not very clean. And, you know, here it steamed away, and the innkeeper said, no, this is no good. I mean, that horse has to go. Well, the uproar was such that, especially as a result of my story, letters came in, telephone calls, telegrams from America, from Asia, anywhere in the world. That horse must be readmitted to the bar. And so he was readmitted to the bar, and then they always had a sort of shovel ready for it, just in case he should leave its droppings again. That was good copy. Did nobody any harm. Everybody had a good smile on the face. I loved it. And I was an instant hero. I didn't even have to, you know, wear a beard as they so often do nowadays to reporters, or crinkle up my forehead. I just wrote this funny story. It was a lovely piece. I enjoyed it so much.
What year was this? What would you say?
Oh, this must have been 1958, 59.
Oh, 59. My goodness. I'd love to find the old microfiche of these stories with Uwe's byline on there about the horse being...
It was even without a byline. It was just...
You were just a stringer, so you just...
No, I was the slot editor. No, I didn't use a byline. Byline you used for features and something grand, you know. Yeah, this was just something that just put out, you know.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Steve, who calls from his car. Steve, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, quick question for you. One of the things that bothers me is the commingling of the editorial page and the news coverage. It's just not print journalism. You see it all the time in electronic journalism. And one of the things I've come to the conclusion is, if I say, for example, I hear something on NPR, people say, well, that's liberal, but they hear it on Rush Limbaugh, it's fact. And what do you think about this whole, where we can't separate the two, and then when we look at an opinion piece, we really can't decipher what the facts are because we're so jaded anymore?
Thank you very much. He talks about two things. First of all, the commingling from the journalist standpoint, but then the inability of the reader or the audience to tell the difference between fact and editorial.
Yeah, and that is actually the worst part of it. By the way, let me make it very clear, whether you commingle news and opinion from the left or from the right-hand side is irrelevant. Both is wrong. And you're absolutely right. People get confused. And remember when I said at the beginning, the most important thing about the consumer of news as sovereign in his nation, I mean, the people, the voter, if you confuse him, then, of course, you're doing a grave disservice, not only to that individual, but to your nation and everybody else, which is precisely why I believe that the news media should be called to task for this business of commingling opinion and facts. And this is very much a product of the post 1960s. The New York Times was one of the papers that started with it, and I heartily urge you to go and see a film about In Cold Blood. It's called Glory Defeats Truman Capote. It's a fantastic film where Truman Capote in the late 50s, early 60s, was one of the progenitors of this development and actually destroyed him as a writer and as a person. After In Cold Blood, he never wrote another book, and he actually died very early of alcoholism, as you know.
So we've talked about journalism as a vocation and as a Christian vocation. So make the case for Christians, especially young people, following in your footsteps and pursuing a vocation as a journalist. Make that case here in the last few minutes.
Well, it is very, any Christian who has a sense of a calling to be a journalist, and I mean not a Christian journalist, a secular journalist in the secular media, you don't have to spread the gospel in the newspapers of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. That's not your calling. If you have that, and if you're qualified, then go out, learn the ropes, learn how to research a story, learn how to write a story, and learn how to sell it to their news editor, your copy editor, your city editor, and then go in there. You, as an individual Christian, can make the difference as long as you bear in mind that your calling is to inform and help your readers, who are your neighbors, who are your fellow citizens, and of course people you are by Christian command to love. All you have to do is to do that. There is no, I'm certain of that, there is no prejudice against Christians in the media as such. The problem is that too many Christians, and I think specifically Lutherans, feel they can't dirty their hands. Well, God has invented soap and water for good reason. So, I mean, you know, dirty your hands and do your job.
Next Monday on Issues Etc., Uwe will be back with us here in Studio A to discuss lay vocation. In the second part of our series, we're going to talk about the other end of this vocation, which is the media consumer. So we consume the newspaper and the magazines and the internet and the television and the radio all day long, each and every one of us. This is a vocation into which each one of us falls, and we'll be talking about that next week on Issues Etc. with Uwe C. Minetto. Uwe, thank you very much for being our guest. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks. Have a great evening.
You as well.
Thank you.
Uwe C. Minetto is an international journalist, resident scholar, and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. He is director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. Go to our website tonight, by the way, and check out the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. And don't go to ours, go to theirs, in fact, www.csl.edu/vocation. Very simple, www.csl.edu/vocation. Tomorrow on the program, Pastor Eric Rotman is going to be our guest. He's from Good News Magazine. He's going to talk to us about suffering. We will also, tomorrow, since we didn't get to it today, reveal the latest sermon from Joel Osteen, this Sunday broadcast of his international program from Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas. And we're going to hear Chapter 3 of this PBS Frontline feature, the one we began today in the first hour, The Last Abortion Clinic, talking about Mississippi and their incremental approach to eliminating abortion by regulating it. We'll hear that tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.